How did you first get into dog mushing?
Well, when I was a little boy, that was everybody in the old days. My dad had a. That's how we got around. Was just by dog team. That was the means of transportation. And I was living at Nenana, Alaska at that time. And my dad always had dogs. And then in those days, they used to have some big races in Ruby and Nome. And they were just starting the races in the early days there in Fairbanks here, the Live and Good race and Signal Corps races. And they'd send out these posters to sell tickets on the dog races to finance them. And that's all they talked about was who had the best dog team and who was going to win the race. And I don't know, ever since I was a little kid, that was my big ambition. And when I finally was 13 years old, I got my first dog of my very own. And I was lucky in the fact that I'd got one of the original Johnny Allen breed of dogs that comes from down in Ruby. And that was one of the top greatest dog mushers of all time, and still is, as far as I'm concerned, in not only the breeding of dogs, but also in the manner that he handled his dogs. He wasn't a harsh whip driver or anything of this nature. He was a man that demanded his dogs to mind and to do their job, but he wasn't constantly after them trying to be harsh about whipping them or hitting them. And I've heard stories about him from the early day dog mushers that said that he could stand in one spot and make a figure eight with his dog team. Now this is what I'm still trying to do.
Johnny Allen was from Ruby, you say?
Yes.
Was he, did he have a lot of, did he do a lot of dog mushing in the Ruby area then?
Well, yes, he mushed and raced in the Ruby area, but he got well known up here. I think he won, it was in the 37, 38, and 39. Won the first man to set as fast a record, broke the 15-mile-an-hour record for 30 miles. And he had at that time a crossbreed that I understand was part wolf and part husky and part Irish setter. And so this is what I've been trying to do, is reduplicate his breed of dogs. And he isn't in the country anymore, but any dog musher that knows anything has heard about him.
Tell me how you got your first dog then when you were 13. Did you know Johnny well enough that he gave you the dog?
No, I got my first dog from Jimmy Bruce. He was from Minto, and it just happened that the breed had gotten down to there. See, in the old days, they didn't fly dogs to Fairbanks or anywhere. And the dog originally came out of the Johnny Allen breed from Ruby. And it was through Harry Riley, and he still lives in Minto and has still a good team. And how the dogs got there was, in the old days, we didn't fly them in like we do today or drive around with trucks. They drove them, actually drove the dog team all the way right along the rivers, and that was the means of transportation. And so what happened is this dog where I got the ancestor of my dogs, the dog happened to be going to have some pups, and he didn't know it at the time, and it was getting too slow, so he left it there with Harry Riley. And so Harry Riley gave him another dog in place of it to use it, and so that's how the breed got out. And in later years, that whole team of Johnny Allen's got drowned. It was going across the river, and there was an overflow, and it opened up. Oh, just across the snow, and the whole team went under, and they lost every one of the dogs. So there's very few of that breed left, and a lot of people that do have it now, they don't even know they have the breed, the few people that is left, you know.
You're still running the same breed in your team now?
Yeah, it's the breed now can be told pretty well by if you look on the tongue of a dog, it has a black spot. And just about every dog in my team has those black spots on their tongue. And I don't know, we try to figure out where that came from. A lot of people say it comes from the wolf, but I can't say for sure where those spots come from. A lot of people say wolves don't even have black spots, but some people do say that.
When you got your first team together, How many dogs did you begin running at 13, and what were you doing with the dogs?
Well, when I was 13, I just had the one dog. And then the next year, well, I got three more brothers out of the same mother. And then I had a four-dog team. Then I was really in business. Then I used them to trap. When I was after school, I'd go out every night, and I'd run about an 8-10 mile trap line. Then on Sunday, I'd go out an extra 5 or 10 miles and go out all day Saturday and all day Sunday. And in those days, we used to get $60-$70 for fox, and mink was the same. Muskrats was running somewhere around $3 and $4. So a lot of times I was making more money than my dad was working for the railroad at the time. And so this way I got out of shoveling coal and a lot of other hard work that I didn't like, you know. And but I think that it's a, you know, wonderful thing for any young boys to get started in. It shows them responsibility and then also compassion and love for other things and other animals and also other people.
Did you train your first dog team yourself?
Yes, I did. I raised it from the time that one leader, and it was the best leader I've ever had in my life, and I just had it with me all the time. And that dog at the end would go gee or haw. You could be running right down the road and it'd just jump right off in the trees if you said gee. When I came to Fairbanks to go to high school, I drove the dogs from Fairbanks or Nenana to Fairbanks, and then that was my transportation, those four dogs. We lived about 3 miles out of town, and I drove them to school, tied them up at the schoolhouse, and then drove back after school and driving. In them days, we didn't have many cars in Fairbanks, but the few that we had, I was passing them, going gee and haw around in between them. So, I mean, it's a... That was our means of transportation, period, in those days.
When you were out trapping with the dogs, did you have to train them in any special way so that you could trap and have the dog team?
Well, it's basically the same as we have now, except you spent more time with the dogs in those days. I'd have them trained like when you're trapping, you couldn't be tying a dog up and or tying your team down and then walking, like I'd walk 1,000 feet and set maybe 8 or 10 traps, and then I trained the dog, so if I tell them to stay, they just lay there. Then after I got up 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet setting the traps, then I'd call them and they'd just come up there to me. And so I had them trained so that they'd stay or they would come at my command, you know. And this is about the way that most of the early day people had their dogs for trapping, because they spent the time, they lived right with them, and the dogs understood them, and they understood the dogs.
How did you have the dogs learn the command to stay?
Well, you just, it's just like training anything, it's just repetition. Like I would take the dogs and tell them to stay, and if they, and just go over and over again, and then if they don't, you know, you reprimand them by hitting them with a switch or whatever. And keep saying it and keep doing this over and over until finally the dog learns, just like you train, well, any animal or any person. It's just repetition over and over. And some dogs are more intelligent than others and easier to train. And if they don't learn, it's just like people. You get rid of them.
So you have to determine whether a dog is smart enough at times and can understand what you're saying, too.
Well, this is true, that some of them it just comes natural. I mean, it's the dogs are, it's bred into them pretty much. It's been generations in hundreds of years. The dogs have been bred just for pulling and working in the cold. So it comes pretty natural, just like we've got our retrieving dogs for hunting.
Gareth, could you tell me about the number of dogs you have right now?
Well, I've got grown dogs right now about 13. Which is one of the lowest number that I've ever had. But there are the best bunch of dogs I've ever had. Of a lot of times people have a big yard full of dogs and they've only got 6 or 7 that are what you'd call real top dogs. But I have about 20 pups out here that I'm raising, hoping to build the team up eventually to 20 to 25 dogs is what I'd like to have. But most people keep that are racing, they keep anywhere from 15 to 40 dogs, depending on what they can afford and this, that, and the other. But the pups are is a pretty tough thing. You never know until the dog is 2 years old whether it's going to really do the job or not. And the dog doesn't really get in his peak till he's about 3.5 to 4 years old. So a lot of times you raise dogs and train them and spend a lot of time, and it's a big disappointment because the dog can't run. Instead of running 17 miles an hour, maybe he can only run 16 miles an hour. And you don't really know this until the dog is grown up. But the best way, though, is to get dogs that have the genes through the breeding in the background, so that at least you've got know that you're working with something that has been proven in the past. And I think this is a mistake that a lot of people do. They think, well, a dog is a dog. And it just isn't so. I mean, it's the same of anything. That's just like if you got a cow. Just because it's a cow don't mean it's going to give 5 gallons of milk a day. Some give 5 and some give only 1. So it's the same thing with chickens with laying eggs, and same thing with dogs if they're good workers or got the speed. And of course, if you're going to work on a freight team, that's a different type of a dog than if you're going to go for the racing dog. But so this is one of the main things a person's got to look to, is the what he really wants to do and what he's looking for and what breed he starts with to work with.
Have you always been careful about the kind of dogs you breed?
Yes, this is one of the most important things. A lot of people think that if they get a good breed and then they don't pay attention to who the father is, and they end up having a good breed, and inside of a generation or two they lose the entire genes of that breed. And the thing is that if you don't actually really be strict about it, and I mean, when a female starts to come into heat, you've got to have a separate pen or place so that it's, you know exactly through visual knowledge that the animal has been bred with that male of your choice that you've chose to breed with the animal. And this is one of the biggest problems that's happened in a lot of the villages, is the fact that they haven't taken the initiative of just saying, well, this has got to be, and taking it seriously. And it's not only in the village, but in the town here, and Anchorage, Fairbanks, anywhere, of people that have got a good breed, and inside of 4 or 5 years they have nothing, and then they wonder why.
Can you take a good dog, one that really shows characteristics of pooling and running, and the kind of things that you want in a sled dog, could you say that kind of dog would be a good breeder, or would that be an incorrect thing to say?
Well, no, naturally it's better to take a dog. The best of anything usually creates something better eventually, but in breeding it's a real tough thing. A lot of time you take two of the best and you just get nothing. But you can take those offspring, maybe, and they that are not showing anything can produce a super dog. But, I mean, it's this is one thing that nobody knows until you actually have tried. Like, if there's a... Usually the genes are held usually in the female. And if you get a female that throws good pups, you'd better hang on to that female, because the female usually is going to throw 6 to 8 pups, and you can get a team in pretty good... 2 or 3 years, you know, if you breed it to the same male that's producing. And to find a good male, though, is really hard compared to a female. There might be one good male in 500, you know, that will produce, whereas you might have one out of every 50 females that might produce, you see. And so this is the thing that most people, they don't realize that they might have a dog that's produced good pups, and then it isn't running good, so they think, well, we'll kill that dog or get rid of it. And really, in essence, they're selling, it's just like selling the goose that lays the golden egg, because those pups might be super dogs, but they might take them and their pups for 5 years from now to ever find another one that will equal the mother of those. So this is the thing. If you have a dog that's going to produce good pups that are proven, and then you'd better hang on to that male or the female, especially the female, because it's carrying the strong genes of producing the speed and the endurance.
Let's say that we have a couple of pups that have just been born that are from a potential good mother and father. What kind of care do you take with these puppies to make sure that they grow up strong and healthy?
Well, you've got to, once they're getting weaned, you should start feeding them at least 2 to 3 times a day. And then most, in this day and age, all the young dogs are born with worms, so you should always worm the pups the first, as they first start getting weaned. And they have this liquid wormer made by Purina that's a real good one. They just add to the feed. And they have directions on the bottle, and it's not very expensive. And it's a real good wormer for young pups. And the main thing is to give them plenty to eat and while they're first getting weaned off, you know, and plenty of water as they're growing up. Then as time goes by, well, then you can cut down to twice a day and then to once a day.
What other kinds of shots should young dogs get?
Well, if there's, you've got to have distemper shots, and if there, if it's been a year where there's been distemper around or going around, you should get a puppy shot. But the dog is usually immune from 6 weeks to 2 months old from the milk from the mother. But after that, if there is distemper in the area, they should have a puppy shot, which will hold them over until they're 14 weeks old, and then you can give them a permanent distemper shot. But a lot of people don't want to confuse a puppy shot with a permanent distemper shot, because a permanent distemper shot, even given when the pup's only, say, 12 weeks old, it won't be permanent. They have to be a minimum of 14 weeks old and to give the permanent shot that will last. And then that lasts more or less indefinitely. These are distemper and hepatitis and some other thing I don't recall.
Mm-hmm. Tell me then about the food you give the dogs also to keep them strong. Do you have a special diet?
Well, yeah, what we do is feed. Well, I feed. I'm Purina, dog food, and I feed the high-energy dog food that they have. But this is not sufficient in the wintertime because of your, if you're racing dogs, you have to add extra protein, through which I add usually through fish. You got to add some fat for the dogs when it's extremely cold. And they have a pretty well-balanced feed, and most of your commercial feeds are, at this time, got the proper vitamins and stuff, but they don't have it for under extreme stress. So you have to add fish if you have salmon or whitefish, or you could even add, you know, dried or whatever. And like right now, I'm feeding whale blubber for my fat, and it's working real well because I use a lot less than I would if I used beef fat or something of this nature.
Do you cook up the blubber first?
No, I just feed it to them raw, cut it, and just like mock duck.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty chewy.
Not for them.
After then, I think we've talked about feeding, but the other important area is training. When do you start working with a dog, a puppy?
Well, there's a lot of different theories on this, but my theory, and I think it's being proven out now in the latest research of all the top dog handlers and trainers of all types of dogs, their new ideas that the sooner you take a young pup and start individually training it, the more chance you have of having that dog become its own. Whereas if you leave a group together, there'll be one or two that are very dominant, and even though there might be one that actually has more ability, he'll tend to, and it's weaker, the other one is going to scare it, and so this one will dominate everything. So the sooner you take them and take those dominant ones out and tie them up and work with them separately, the better off you are. I know they've had some tests on German Shepherds where they figured that out of a litter of 6, they were lucky to get one that was an exceptional seeing-eye dog. And now they've taken those pups at 6 weeks old and separated them. And they're getting as high as 90% of those pups as top seeing-eye dogs, whereas they were lucky to get one before. And the psychological effect that they have, I mean, it sounds funny to talk about dogs having psychology like humans, but it's a true. And, I mean, certain ones are aggressive and certain other ones are timid. And so a lot of those timid ones would end up being aggressive and might be your top lead dog if you gave it the time and spent the time with it at an earlier age. But as far as actually training, I take my pups and I start training them at about 2 months old to follow me. And I walk out and go maybe the first time just 1,000 feet and just play with them and bring them back. Then as they get older, then I take and I run on my snowgo and I have them chase me. And I'll go as high as, even with a dog 8 months old, I'll go as high as 15, 16 miles. And I've had 19 pups follow at one time, and they just follow just me, and that's all. I can go through dog kennels, through horses, around moose, anything, and those dogs will just follow that one machine. And this, I feel, is very important because I'm able to determine which are the fastest, which are the most aggressive and trying to keep up. And if a dog is going to quit when he's a pup, he's going to quit when he's grown up. And so I feel this is a good way of training and eliminating waiting for that 3 or 4 year period. And so this is one of the methods. Then by the time they're about 8 to 9 months old, then you start putting them in harness. And a lot of times one that'll run good might not take to the harness right away. So if he doesn't take to it, I mean, you might have to spend a little extra time, but usually the ones that like to run, they're going to like to run in the team.
Do you usually put the young pups with a team that's already experienced, or do you start with a pup without any experienced dogs?
Well, no, you're always better off to have, you should at least have good lead dogs and swing dogs. Then if you, you're better off to run an old dog and a young dog and then on back. If you have four pups, say run one with an old dog, they'll teach them to mind. And if you get a whole team of pups together, they'll just about chew your tow line up before you get started out of the yard.
how many dogs in the team do you have when you're starting to train pups?
Well, usually you should have a smaller team, and you don't want to start out going fast. You can ruin a good dog if by putting one or two pups in a fast team, because they'll get going and they'll lose their balance and start getting choked, and then they're afraid from then on. So your best bet is to take, say, maybe if you have a good lead dog and a couple of good swing dogs, and then put in about three pups at a time, take maybe a 5 or 7 dog team. And then if the dog lays down, we'll go up and pet it and talk to it and reassure it, you know, that it's not going to get killed on its first trip out. And then as time goes by, they'll pick up and just start working. And then you can increase the number. But it's better to keep a smaller team, because if you have a dog fight or any trouble, then you're able to stop it and handle the team. And you shouldn't put a big team together until you have all experienced dogs and that they know what they're doing and what you're doing.
Tell me how you, when your daily routine of practice with the dogs, tell me about how you bring the dogs up to their peak so they can run in the longer races.
Well, the main thing is you got to start as early as possible in the fall, and if possible in the summer, it doesn't hurt to run them once a week, and some people say twice a week just for a mile or 2 miles. But I've never had time to do that, so I start usually in October and November, and then I'll start running them 7, 8 miles, and I'll just run them that way for about a month. But as they increase, then I put weights on them to make them work. And really, if you got a proven dog, you don't have to run it no 20, 30, 40 miles to get it in shape to run for a 30-mile race. Last year, I came in second, and I had 19-month-old pups, and I furthest I ran them was 9.5 miles. But that 9.5 miles, it was working constantly on a pulling. Like, if they... what they could have run empty, they probably took them half again to, as long, because they're still expending the energy.
Gareth, what kind of a training trail do you have here?
Well, I've got actually a rather rough one. It goes, I have to cross a major highway, and then I go through rather brushy country up to next to the Tanana River, and it's I don't keep a real smooth trail. A lot, there's a different concept there. A lot of people feel in training race dogs that you should have a completely smooth, even trail, and now this is debatable and it's up to each individual, but like myself, I believe in training on a rougher trail, and then I feel that if the, when you get on the smoother race trail that you're going to be that much more advantage. And if you do happen to hit a rough trail in some race, which most races now they don't have too rough trails, but at least I feel that if you start with the worst, you can always get it always gets better. But right now I run a trail that's approximately 7 miles, and then I have it jumps up to 10, 12, and I can go up to 15, and even up to 26 miles if I wanted to. But basically all I use now is just the 7 and the 12-mile training trail. And I've just built it with a snow go, but I always make it wider. I make it 3 snow goes wide, so this way I can train for passing teams without having them fall off in a snowbank. And I think this is a real important part of training, is having your trail so that when you catch a team, your dogs aren't going to be having to get out in deep snow. Because especially young dogs, you tend to ruin them if they don't continue passing, you know, without getting bitten or something like this. And this gives room for you to pass, and your most race trails are anywhere from 6 to 10 feet wide. But this trail is, I just let it, whatever the snow go, and I drag a tire usually to smooth it out. And another important thing in training is that a lot of times people got their dogs in shape, but their dogs' feet go out. And what caused this a lot of times is in cold weather training, there'll be this ice frost that'll fall out of the air, and it just doesn't look like anything, but it's just like a dust on the hard trail. And then this tends to get in their toes and next to their toenails, and in essence, it's actually freezing them. And a lot of times you won't even know it until after you've run 4 or 5 times or a week, and it finally comes that they've actually been frostbitten. And then the dogs get sore feet, and then you wonder why they're not running. And so this is something that you got to really watch, and a lot of times you should clear your trail previous to running if this condition exists. And we usually run 3 teams a day, and so I pull a tire, and this tends to brush that snow off. And then you'll run your slower dogs first, and then your better dogs afterwards. And that's about that.
Tell me what kinds of equipment you have when you first, the training equipment, the kind of equipment you use when you're out on the trail around here, and then second, the kind of equipment you use for races.
Well, yeah, when you're training, you want to have a heavier sled. And I usually use a steel runners because they're harder pulling, and then, of course, they never wear out. And when it's cold, steel pulls real hard, and so this gives more power for the dogs to pull on. And then the harnesses we use are just called the Siwash harness, which goes over the head and under the arms. And it's used most generally by everybody. It was originated around Huslia. And the tow lines, we run 2 dogs together, of course. Everybody knows that. We don't run like in Canada where they're single file with single trees or anything. And, of course, then there's the Eskimo-style fan hitch. But, I mean, in dog racing here, neither one of those are useful because fan hitch, you'd be running into trees and all your dogs you'd be in one heck of a mess. And the single hitch, you'd be around the track before you got back, I think, especially hooking up 16 or 18 dogs. And the trails are quite crooked a lot of times, too, so you've got to have your team as close as you can. But you don't make your tow lines too short because this tends to pull the dogs down. And you got to have a length of about 7 to 10 feet, depending on the size of the dog, between each section. And this keeps the dog from, if it's too short, it'll tend to pull his hind end down and then cripple him, see. And the same thing on your necklines. You got to have them not too short so that it's constantly choking him, but you don't want them too long either so that he's getting his leg over to trip on them.
Who makes up your dog lines and your harnesses?
Well, I make my own dog lines up, and right now there's a Jim Pinkerton that builds dog harnesses, and he does a real good job, puts padding on them and everything out of nylon. And most of the people have been getting them from him up here lately. But up until he came around here a couple of years ago, well, we all more or less made our own.
What kind of material are the dog lines made out of?
Well, we usually use this polyethylene and use 3/16 inch for the neck lines and the tug lines, and then 3/8 inch for the main tow line. Except if you have a long string, then the two front, the lead dog and the two swing dogs, you'll use maybe 1/4 inch because they don't need that heavy of a line. And then if you do have a big line, big team like that, you might make the back four dogs out of 1/2 inch line.
Tell me more about the sled, the kind of sled that you use when you're training dogs and when you're racing. Is it a long sled with several stanchions on it for training?
Well, no, usually for training we have about maybe it varies, you know, but usually we'll have about a 5 or 6 foot, 4 to 6 foot basket, and that way we could haul weight in if we want to and carry extra gear or whatever. And then for racing, usually have about a 3.5 or 4 foot basket. But your training sled usually has shorter runners in back, and your racing sled, the runners just about equal the length of the basket. It's just about like a pair of skis for your racing sled. Then most people use this ski, what the heck's the name of that? P-Tex, yeah. And put that on there, and that's about the fastest surface for most every weather. Used to be we'd use different ski waxes and then metal for if it was warmer, but the Speedtex is just about as all weather as you could get and still be as fast as surface. And then your sleds, there's all different kinds that people use. There's birch sleds, like I have birch sleds that were made in Enana now. And if a man gets good straight birch and season right, it's as good of a wood as hickory or anything else. It's a lot lighter and just as strong. But a lot of times the people, they don't build with straight grain, and then they'll say the birch sled is not good. But I would say it's as strong, if not as better, of a sled that there is if you have it properly aged in straight grain.
How would you age that birch to make it the right... Well, first, would you start with the green birch and bend the green birch, or would you age it first and then bend it?
Well, you can do it either way. but the thing is that they'll usually take and get the green birch and bend the runners and then let the other stuff dry, you know, and build a stanchion and stuff, but they'll usually bend the green... the runners when it's still green because it's easier to bend, and then let it dry right on the form. But it takes a season, a good full season, to age the birch enough to have it good. But a lot of people build it, cut it down and dry it for a month in the house and then expect the thing to stay straight. Whereas your hickory is your most hickory and ash they build out of. But they're a heavier sled and it's so hard to get it, the material. But they have this Moody sled that Lombard and a lot of these people have been using. This guy by the name of Moody builds them out there in New England. And they cost about $250, the sled.
Gareth, will you give me your opinion about dog mushing today?
Well, actually, I think dog mushing today and in the future is the only way to go. I mean, the people have gone through the Snow-Go deal, and really what fun can you have out there with a bunch of smoke in your face and a bunch of noise? I think the day has come now where people are starting to realize that you got to get back to nature, and what better way is there than through the dogs, and the feeling of responsibility that you have, and the feeling of achievement that you have by working with a... why dogs are so intriguing to many people is the fact that it isn't like a horse. A horse is just one animal, and once you've got it trained or something, you don't have the feeling of achievement that you might have with dogs, because each one is an individual, and when you get them working as a team, then you have this sense of real down inner feeling of achievement of not only yourself but of a group of other living things. And I think that this is one of the best things that younger people and kids especially can get into, because it teaches them that they have another living thing that they have got to feed and is looking to them, sort of like a lot of people look to God or whatever they look to. These animals are dependent completely and entirely upon this person that is feeding them, watering them, and driving them and training them. And for going out into the woods, whether you're trapping or just sightseeing or just getting in the fresh air, the dogs are the only thing. They're natural to the country. They belong to the country. And this sense of feeling that you'll get, you can't feel it unless you try it. And once you get this feeling, you'll be stuck. And it's wonderful. And it teaches the children the responsibility that they're going to have to face in later life. And so I feel that the sooner that any kid, whether he has one dog or two dogs or three dogs or a whole team, the sooner they get into it and the more interest they take in it, I think the parents should be more than happy to help them with what little it costs, because out in the villages they can fish, and this is another thing. It teaches them to put up and see, like they can dry their fish, and when they're trapping for beaver and muskrat and other animals, they'll utilize this as dog food, and it gives a great sense of well-being to the person to know that he is self-sufficient in doing something for himself and his family and for these animals that are dependent upon him. So I think that there's wouldn't be, like you take a snow machine, I mean, when it stops or runs out of gas, when you're pouring gas, you get smelly mittens and the darn spark plug quits and the thing breaks. And I mean, you can't have this feeling of in the natureness as you can with dogs. And so I feel that it's one of the most worthwhile sports as far as dog mushing and racing, but also just as an individual means of transportation and enjoyment.